From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, a new novel about incest from a writer who says she hates the whole literature of victimology and considers many books on incest pseudo-porn. We'll talk with the author, Dorothy Allison. Also, can a Latino raised in Los Angeles in the 70s deny that the Brady Bunch has as much cultural significance to them as the Virgin de Guadalupe? We'll talk with Ruben Martinez, who writes about race, class, and culture in the LA Weekly and in his new book, The Other Side. And rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the new album from Sonic Youth. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations Security Council has condemned yesterday's attack on a UN convoy near Sarajevo and said it's ready to adopt new measures to protect UN personnel in Bosnia. More details have been emerging in Sarajevo about the attack that killed two French peacekeeping troops. Matt Fry reports for the BBC.
This is what seems to have happened. The UN convoy of 35 vehicles approached the Muslim village of Butmir after it had been assured that the fighting in the area would stop. But as the vehicles arrived, machine gun fire from Bosnian positions raked the convoy. Both the UN and the Bosnian government have described the culprits as irregulars and rogue elements. In Zagreb, Saris Vance called it cold-blooded murder. Unfortunately, this war is full of unpredictable rogue elements. As Brigadier General Razek put it, there are no front lines and the UN is not respected. One question which he was unable to answer was why the UN convoy did not have an armored escort, even though there had been heavy fighting around the airport for 3 days. The killing of the French soldiers is seen by UN troops here as a turning point. Either the UN beefs up its operation, or it should bow out altogether.
Matt Fry reporting from Sarajevo. President Bush campaigned today in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, where he renewed the pledge that he broke in 1990. The president told a rally in Middletown, New Jersey, that he would never raise taxes again. And the president said, "I went along with one Democratic tax increase, and I'm not going to do it again, ever, ever." He acknowledged that the country has been through what he called economic hell, but said the United States is now poised for a strong recovery. Although the president has portrayed himself as an opponent of taxes, today was the first time since 1990 that he has flatly promised not to raise taxes. Bill Clinton campaigned in Georgia today. He spoke about welfare reform during a visit to a suburban community center. NPR's Mara Liasson has more.
Clinton delivered his speech on welfare reform in Jonesboro, a suburban Atlanta town represented until reapportionment by Newt Gingrich. The audience was almost completely white. These are the kind of suburban voters Clinton has been reaching out to this year. He told them his welfare reform program would provide education, training, and child care to welfare recipients, but would put a 2-year limit on welfare benefits. Clinton said his program would cost $6 billion over the next 4 years, and he offered what sounded like a painless way to find the money through defense cuts, increased taxes on the wealthy, and trimming government waste. The Clinton campaign also unveiled a television ad today on welfare reform. It claims that Clinton has moved 17,000 people off the welfare rolls in Arkansas. In Atlanta, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Dow Industrials gained 11 points today to close at 3,271. This is NPR. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has postponed a trip to Japan amid pressure to resolve the two countries' claims to the Kuril Islands. The islands are part of a chain that stretches between northern Japan and the Russian Far East. Japan refers to the islands as its northern territories, but they were occupied by the Soviet Union in 1945. Many Russians had expressed fear that Yeltsin would give up two of the four Kuril Islands during his trip in exchange for major economic assistance from Tokyo. The dispute has been a major stumbling block in relations between the two countries. Yeltsin's office gave no details about the reasons for postponing his trip. Israel will present a new position paper to Syria when peace talks resume in Washington next week. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Israeli negotiators say their first task is to work out a joint statement of principles with Syria, such as the commitment to a full peace with mutual security. If they succeed, it will be the first document signed jointly by the two states. The announcement came as Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin addressed a special Knesset session, hinting that he is prepared to give up parts of the Golan Heights in exchange for peace with Syria. Rabin reiterated that Israel believes that UN Resolution 242, which calls for land for peace, applies to the Golan Heights. But he also said that Israel could not withdraw completely, as it did from the Sinai, in exchange for peace with Egypt. But Syrian President Hafez Assad has a different position. In Damascus today, he said he will never give up one inch of the Golan Heights. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Lawyers for Brazilian President Fernando Collor sought today to fend off his possible impeachment by appealing to the Brazilian Supreme Court. They asked the court to annul a congressional order that gives Collor 1 week to prepare his defense against charges that he profited from an influence peddling scheme. The lower house of Brazil's Congress is considering a formal request for Collor's impeachment. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dorothy Allison has written a new novel about a girl who was sexually abused by her stepfather. Yet, Allison has said that she hates most of the books on incest and considers many of them to be pseudo-porn. When I asked her what makes her think people use books about incest as a turn-on, she told me because her stepfather used to keep a pile of them under his bed. This is the stepfather who abused Allison throughout her childhood. Her new novel, Bastard Out of Carolina, is about violence and incest in a poor Southern family. In the New York Times Book Review, George Garrett wrote, "The literary territory that Allison has set out to explore is dangerous turf, a minefield. It is a great pleasure to see her succeed, blithe and graceful as Baryshnikov in performance." Allison says she has tried to avoid the pitfalls of the literature of victimology by being as honest as possible. But being honest means describing the disturbing, confusing thoughts of the victim. You'll get a sense of that from this reading, a third of the way into the book.
It's essentially about the point where she's old enough and things have progressed enough that the abuse has become unavoidable. I didn't daydream about fire anymore. Now I imagine people watching while Daddy Glenn beat me, though only when it was not happening. When he beat me, I screamed and kicked and cried like the baby I was. But sometimes, when I was safe and alone, I would imagine the ones who watched. Someone had to watch. Some girl I admired who barely knew I existed. Some girl from church or down the street, or one of my cousins, or even somebody I'd seen on TV. Sometimes, a whole gang of them would have to be trapped into watching. They couldn't help me. They couldn't get away. They had to watch. In my imagination, I was proud and defiant. I'd stare back at him with my teeth set, making no sound at all, no shameful scream, no begging. And those people who watched admired me and hated him. I pictured it that way, and I put my hands between my legs. It was scary, but it was thrilling, too. Those who watched me loved me. It was as if I was being beaten for them. And I was wonderful in their eyes.
You understand this fantasy of having people watch you and admire you as you're beaten but remain defiant?
Yes. It's curious because it's what I did as a child, and I've talked to other survivors, and it's one of the ways in which you can fight the feeling of being this contemptible being. Because basically when you're subjected to that kind of abuse, as a child, you almost always begin to feel that it's justified, that there is really something wrong with you, that you're this terrible person that this is happening to. And the only way I ever found, really, to deal with the emotional onslaught of those feelings was to begin to feel like a martyr, this almost Joan of Arc figure in my own mind.
Something that really upsets the girl in this story. She hates the beatings. She hates the incest. She hates her stepfather. But she's turned on by the stories she tells herself about the beatings.
Yes.
And masturbates to those stories that she makes up. And she feels terribly guilty about this.
Absolutely.
And she thinks that maybe she's as guilty as her stepfather is.
Mm-hmm.
That's something you understand, too?
Oh, yes. And it's hard to explain to people on the outside of the experience, mostly because it's really hard to admit that you could take that experience and convert it into your own erotic charge. I don't know how to explain it. I don't know how to analyze it. I simply know that it happens and it becomes a way to make it your own experience.
I think one of the reasons why someone might be reluctant to admit to a feeling like that is not only their own kind of fear at what they were feeling, but also the fear that somebody would say, well, see, that must have mean she enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
You know?
It's like the myth of rape, you know. Obviously, if you orgasm during rape, then it must not have been rape. So if a child begins to feel erotic excitement while being manipulated by an adult, does that give the adult permission to do it? It's a horrible thing to even imagine. And you don't, part of the reason to keep it a secret and to be quiet about that feeling is that you might give someone any small measure of encouragement to feel they have a right to do this. They have no right ever to sexually touch a child. It's just not possible to do. There's no justification for it. And the fact that the child might, in fact, manufacture some erotic excitement is not a justification for it. But if we pretend that it doesn't happen, then that guilt, that self-horror stays, never goes away.
When you hear about somebody having experienced sexual pleasure while they were being victimized,
well, what upsets me is that they're then ashamed of themselves for it.
Uh-huh.
That I find upsetting. We don't have, especially if you're a child, I mean, my incest started when I was 5 years old. I wasn't capable of making any decision about what I wanted to do. I didn't have the capacity to do that. When I began to feel all these funny feelings that I could not explain to myself, all I experienced was horror. I began to think that I was the terrible person I was being told I was. And it's taken me most of my life to make the decision that that's not the case.
Did you punish yourself when you were young for feelings that you thought you shouldn't have?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think there's any way that that does not happen. Because you can, you feel like that the worst thing you do is if you don't automatically just hate and abhor everything. Especially if it becomes a trade-off, you know, like, all right, if this day he doesn't hit you and you something else happens and you start thinking, well, that wasn't so bad, then your guilt becomes enormous. I think that's where some of the most excruciating damage is. That's where it takes place.
In the self-punishment.
Yeah. And in this concept of yourself as this horrible, sick person, you begin to feel like it's your fault. And the worst thing is that you begin to feel like the perpetrator is your victim. And that's, of course, something that the perpetrator always encourages.
That the perpetrator is your victim. Would you explain that?
Well, I can't talk for lots of other people. My experience was my perpetrator always was saying, I just can't help myself. You know, it's just you. It's just you. And you tell a child that often enough, and they'll begin to believe you.
There's something very flattering in that, too, isn't there?
Well, it's a kind of backwards flattering if what they're doing is something that horrifies you.
Right, right.
But the attention can be flattering.
That's what I meant. Yeah, that's what I meant by somebody that's telling you basically that you're special.
Yeah.
You know?
And you're engaged in this enormous drama.
Mm-hmm.
This is the thing that I don't think people talk enough about. That can be very exciting in a way. You know, every day is a new piece of the drama. Now, every night is a horror because you're going back into this absolute pit of shame and self-contempt.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Dorothy Allison. She's written a new novel called Bastard Out of Carolina. Would you tell us the story your relatives told you about how you were born?
I was born in a car accident. My mother was on the way to the airport with a bunch of my uncles and aunts, and they hit another car, and she was in the back seat asleep. So she was thrown over the front seat, through the windshield, over the other car. She wasn't hurt too bad, except that she had a concussion and was unconscious for 3 days. And, of course, I was born while she was unconscious, which meant that my grandmother and my aunts were at the hospital, and they got into an argument while talking to the clerk and didn't manage to manufacture the manufactured marriage my mother had been going to get through. So I became a certified bastard.
How old was she when she gave birth to you?
15. 1 month past her 15th birthday. She was a child.
How old was she when she married? She did eventually marry, right?
My mother married three times. Well, the first marriage was annulled. But she married my stepfather when I was five and lived with him until she died.
And he was the man who abused you when you were growing up?
Yes.
Did she know about it?
Yes and no. One of the things that's hard to explain to people is that my mother knew because there were... I told her. Actually, I didn't tell her. I told one of my cousins who told her. But it's very hard. What's hard to explain is that she did not let herself know all of everything that was happening. She couldn't have. And when I grew up and I would go home and talk to her, we would have these very long, slow, painful conversations. And she was enormously guilty that she had not been able to stop it. And she tried. That's one of the hard things that I try to show in the book is, like my mother, Annie in the book, tries desperately to prevent what she sees happening, even though she doesn't see a lot of what's going on. And she tries to protect her children. She believes absolutely that the man she loves is going to change, that what's happening is just because he can't find a job, because his father is mean to him, because he's hurt and wounded, that he's just... She thinks of him as this little boy that she's going to mother into being a good man. And she cannot believe that that's not happening.
So you must have been very angry with your mother for staying with your stepfather after she knew for certain what was happening to you.
Not until I was in my 30s did I really start to get angry at her in that way. My mother loved me. My mother spent her whole life desperately trying to make my life and the lives of my sisters better. She literally worked herself to death, taking care of us, trying to make some small difference. And if you had ever had a way to meet her, you would have met someone that was just extraordinarily loving and a very large soul human being. And I was madly in love with my mother. And I knew how impossible her life was. She worked as a waitress her whole life. The best job she ever had was as a cook. She was constantly sick. There was enormous bills. She never, never got her life under control. And she always thought if she just worked a little harder, did this little thing more, it would be possible. That having her there, having her like this barrier between me and what was essentially a really cruel world, I loved her enormously. I could not possibly have been angry at her while I was at home. And for a long time after, she was my heroine. It was only when I began to really deal with the problems in my own life that had resulted as being, that getting out of being the victim and into being a survivor was when I started to get angry. And it was nightmarish. To be angry at her that way.
What kind of terms were you on when she died?
I went, the month before my mother died was the first time in 20 years that I stayed in her home. Up to that point, I had always, when I got money together, I'd send her a plane ticket and have her come visit me. I did not go home. I refused to stay in my stepfather's house once I was an adult. But that last... I was there 2 weeks in the month before she died, and I left. When the day I left, she told me it was the best 2 weeks of her life because it was one of the last chances we had to really talk. And she had finally stopped being so guilty, and we could really just be with each other and love each other.
She was still living with your stepfather then?
Yes.
So he's still alive?
Oh, yes.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk more about your writing and about your life. My guest is Dorothy Allison, and her new novel is called Bastard Out of Carolina. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Dorothy Allison is my guest. Her new novel is called Bastard Out of Carolina. But Dorothy, I'm going to ask you to read something from the preface to a collection of short stories that came out a few years ago. And the collection of short stories is called Trash. Would you read the opening of the preface for us? It's titled Sure. Deciding to Live.
I became the one who got away, who got glasses from the Lions Club, a job from Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, and finally went to college on a scholarship. There I met the people I had always read about, girls whose fathers loved them innocently, boys who drove cars they had not stolen, whole armies of the middle and upper classes I had not truly believed to be real, the children to whom I could not help but compare myself. I matched their innocence, their confidence, their capacity to trust, to love, to be generous against the bitterness, the rage, the pure and terrible hatred that had consumed me. And like so many others who had gone before me, I began to dream longingly of my own death. I began to court it, cowardly, traditionally, that is, in the tradition of all those who had gone before me, through drugs and drinking and stubbornly putting myself in the way of other people's violence. Even now, I cannot believe how it was that everything I survived became one more reason to want to die.
Why do you think you went through a self-destructive period after having decided to live and getting away from home?
Oh, dear, it's like math. It's like one and one. You take a child and rob that child of all self-esteem, you will get an adult that has no sense of their own worth. I spent a good portion of my late teens and early 20s trying to find a way to die without having to actually take the responsibility to kill myself. It's a direct result. I've seen it in so many other people. I've seen it in some of my younger relatives. It's a devastating impact. The hard thing is to change it, to crawl out of that black depression and begin to think of yourself as a human being like other human beings instead of a monster.
What helped you do that?
I'll tell you the truth. I think it was feminism. I began to believe that there was an explanation for what had happened to me. And I came to it largely through a political understanding. I went away to college and somebody talked to me about Marx and showed me, you should be a communist. They said you're working class. Well, I'm not much good at that because communists need to do what they're told. But I started reading and trying to study. Why is it that these things happen and why is it that everybody especially believe that incest and violence happens to poor and working class kids? And I lucked into a study group, a feminist study group. And all of a sudden, it was bigger. It wasn't just that we were poor. It was because I was a girl child and because girl children in my family are taught to endure and survive and not to fight back. And that began to let me be angry. It began to let me believe that I wasn't this monster that deserved what had happened to her, but somebody who had fallen under somebody else's madness.
You did something that it sounds like nobody else in your family had done before. You left home. You went someplace else. You tried to have a life different from the lives you had seen around you. How did you make that move?
Oh, I did something. I did a number of things nobody else in my family had done before. I was the first person in my family to graduate from high school, the first person to go to college. There have been two since. And I have come of an enormous family. It's just that both of my sisters dropped out of high school in the 9th and 10th grade. It's just not something that we were given the idea that we could do. But a lot of it had to do with my mother. My mother believed that I was this incredibly special person, that I was brilliant. She thought that I was just amazing. So when I was 5 or 6 years old, she started getting me books, and she started saving money to send me to school. She would put quarters in a tip jar. She did it my entire childhood. At the point I went to college, she had almost $200, and she'd been saving for more than 10 years.
Wow.
It wasn't exactly a life in which you could keep money.
Yeah.
But that, if you make that decision with my mother's encouragement, believing that I was different, a lot of other things come along. The poor get these funny kinds of encouragements that or kind of backhanded encouragement. I mean, it's true. I was I got my glasses from the Lions Club when I was 7 years old. That's how I finally got glasses. I got scholarships to college that were largely based on the fact that we were very poor. So you get those Kiwanis Club awards. Now, those things are marvelous, and it's really wonderful, and you desperately need the money. But, Lord, they make you feel like such a, like an animal, like a startling and surprising animal.
Why? So,
because, of course, you're the special one. You're like the freak amongst this family of trash. And somehow everything you do becomes a reproach to the rest of your family. The fact that I was so bright and won so many prizes and awards and things drove me away from my family. I didn't have any choice about leaving. I didn't know how to talk to them after a while. The hard part was going back.
Right. So something else that set you apart from your family and probably from a lot of people who you knew growing up is that you're a lesbian.
Ah, yes.
How old were you when you figured that out?
I think it was about 11.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't entirely sure all of what it meant. I just knew that I didn't have any of the same desires that everybody else around me. I wasn't much interested in boys or the whole cycle that you get into of getting boyfriends and doing that whole thing. But I was madly, passionately in love with the little girl down the street. And I was always in love with the little girl down the street, no matter what little girl it was or where we were. I don't think there was a day in my adolescence that I was not madly in love with somebody, and she was always female.
Now, when you were young, things were much less in the open about homosexuality than now. And I think
it's a bit scary.
People who were gay and lesbian were really encouraged to think of themselves as sick and perverted. Coming from a kind of background where you were already really worried and really guilty about who you were and why your stepfather was abusing you, thinking that you liked girls probably or might have brought on... Yeah, right.
I began to think or worry that people would think that I loved girls because my stepfather had raped me. It was one of the...
Well, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are thinking that right now, frankly.
Almost everyone that I've ever talked to says, well, that's it. That's why. But I don't believe it. I believe that my lesbianism has been a source of energy and power in my life. It's almost as if, oh, you must hate men because he did these terrible things to you. That's why you love women. But I don't think of it that way. I don't love women because I hate men. I don't even particularly hate men. I happen to love women. And lust is a little bit more basic than running away, you know?
No, there's a scene in your novel where the sheriff comes after an incident of abuse to talk to the girl. And mm-hmm. she looks at him and she thinks, you're my stepfather.
Yeah.
And she looks at a lot of men in positions of authority and just sees them as, you know, her stepfather in a uniform.
Yeah. For a long time, that's how I thought. And I think that power over dynamic is a big part of authoritarian men. But the thing I have also learned is that it's not the case for all men. It would be so simple. You know, the tempting thing about that kind of analysis is if you said, aha, the problem must be in that Y chromosome will just get it out. But that's not it. I've learned that there are authoritarian, abusive women. what it is that power over the weak that's the problem. And that's something you can't explain away easily by sex or gender.
Well, Dorothy Allison, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dorothy Allison's new novel is Bastard Out of Carolina. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, race, class, and rage in Los Angeles. We talk with Ruben Martinez, who writes for the LA Weekly and has a new collection of articles about life in LA and youth culture in Latin America. Also, we'll listen to new music from the band Sonic Youth. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush campaigned today in the Northeast before heading back to the Middle West tomorrow in what his aides call a major economic address. Speaking today in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, Mr. Bush conceded that the state of the U.S. economy is lousy, but he said the nation is now poised for a decent and strong recovery. The president criticized Democratic challenger Bill Clinton's record on the environment and education and said the Arkansas governor is in with the crowd who says no to innovations for the nation's classrooms. Seeking Jewish support for his election campaign, Democrat Bill Clinton addressed the International Convention of B'nai B'rith by satellite today. He promised strong support for Israel and for other causes embraced by American Jews. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Bill Clinton promised to maintain Israel's military superiority if elected. He promised continued U.S. economic aid for the Jewish state and said he would keep the Mideast peace talks going.
I want to be very clear about this. There will be no hiatus in the current negotiations.
Governor Clinton also addressed domestic concerns of the Jewish American community, concerns that George Bush largely avoided in his remarks before B'nai B'rith yesterday. The governor promised to improve American schools, revive the economy, fight bigotry, and work for a Supreme Court that will, in his words, protect our Constitution, protect a woman's right to choose, and protect the rights of all Americans. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Capitol Hill, the Senate has voted to confirm Alabama prosecutor Edward Carnes to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. His opponents charge that Carnes is racially insensitive because he supported sentences imposed by juries from which African Americans were routinely excluded. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
One reason the Carnes nomination attracted so much attention is that he will replace retiring U.S. Circuit Court Judge Frank Johnson, Jr. Johnson's rulings in the 1950s and 60s provided the legal basis for much of the civil rights movement. This morning, Carnes supporters won a key procedural vote by a 66-30 margin, six votes more than were needed to choke off a filibuster mounted by his opponents. That ended the debate and immediately brought the nomination to a final vote. A simple 51-vote majority was needed to win. Carnes won with 62 senators voting for his confirmation and 36 voting against. The Carnes nomination is likely to be one of the last the Senate considers this year. Senate Democrats hope Bill Clinton wins the White House and will send up new judicial nominees. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 11 points to close at 3,271.38 in fairly active trading. This is NPR News. In South Africa, President F.W. de Klerk has called for urgent talks and a new effort to stop the escalating violence in his nation. At the same time, he also criticized the African National Congress, charging that communists in the ANC leadership are trying to sabotage changes. Earlier this week, 24 ANC supporters were killed by government troops in a black homeland. In June, the ANC pulled out of talks aimed at ending white minority rule, but private contacts with the South African government have continued. In Detroit, talks resumed today in a strike by city teachers that has left nearly 170,000 students out of school for over a week now. Phil Denieri of member station WDET reports.
Bargaining in the 10-day-old walkout has been slowed in part by depleted ranks in the state of Michigan's mediation service, But as other disputes have been settled, intense bargaining has resumed in Detroit. The teachers' union has asked that the question of empowerment or site-based school management be taken off the table so that economic questions can be settled and school can resume. The Detroit School Board, though, says site-based management is crucial to its plans for school reform, and it will not take the issue off the table. One of the key issues in bargaining is over how much authority local schools will have to make modifications in the contract after it is signed. There are no signs that the strike will end in the near future. For National Public Radio, I'm Phil Denieri in Detroit.
A new Chamber of Commerce survey indicates that business confidence has fallen sharply this summer after increasing during the first half of the year. The new Business Confidence Index of the Chamber of Commerce indicates that business is much less hopeful about the state of the U.S. economy than it was during the first 6 months of 1992. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against other major foreign currencies. Gold prices were also up. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Ruben Martinez says just about all he talks about nowadays is the L.A. riots and the aftermath. Some of the issues underlying the riots, like racism and the clash of cultures in the city, are issues he's been writing about for years in the L.A. Weekly. He's also been writing about the clash of cultures within himself. Martinez's mother is Salvadoran. His father is Mexican. Martinez grew up in an Anglo-Jewish middle-class neighborhood in L.A. He was weaned on a blend of cultures, and to better understand them, he's recently traveled extensively through Latin America. Essays about those travels are included in his new book, The Other Side, Fault Lines, Guerrilla Saints, and the True Heart of Rock and Roll. His ethnic identity is a source of pride now, but he confesses that back when he was in public school, he had to fill out an ethnic survey, and when asked to check white, black, or Mexican, he checked other.
Back then, this is the late 60s and early 70s that we're talking about, to say that you were Mexican sounded dirty. Just even to say the word, you could almost hear the preface of the word dirty Mexican, as in dirty Mexican. I certainly had been called it several times, as my father had, who grew up basically in the same neighborhood in the 40s and 50s. Not much had changed by the 60s. There was still a lot of racial prejudice. So growing up where I did grow up, where I was basically the only Latino kid on the block, rather an anomaly in the neighborhood, I did everything I could to assimilate. I felt that it was either join them or not, you know, or be beaten. And I did my best to speak a perfect English, to become part of the Brady Bunch reality, to basically become Anglo. And so this was, you know, expressed even through the ethnic surveys. I thought I could check that box that said other and write in the word Spanish. Because Spanish, you know, denoted something European and something whiter than I was. And so it was basically becoming the other, which is a process that I experienced for many, many years, and that ultimately set the stage for a big cultural battle inside my soul. Because by the time I was 18, 19, that assimilation game that I'd played when I was younger had basically also made me pay a huge price. And I was angry, so angry at that time when I finished high school, and I didn't know at what or at who. But eventually I came to realize that it was because I'd been denying a part of myself for many, many years. I'd been repressing the Latino side of myself for so many years. And you can't stuff, you know, your soul that deep inside you, you know, stamp it down or stamp it out without it coming back to haunt you one day. And at first I didn't know what it was, so this anger led me to all kinds of scenes, whether it was, you know, the punk, you know, rock scene or reading Jack Kerouac and going on the road like crazy looking for something, and I didn't know what I was looking for. Eventually, after all the rock and roll and sex and drugs of the early 80s, I figured that it was culture that was the real battle. And I began to travel to Latin America a lot, and those travels are basically what The Other Side is about.
So did you go through extremes early on in that roots trip?
To say the least, extremes. I went from having been an assimilationist all the way to the other side to being an absolute nationalist radical that would reject anything that smacked of the European. I also fancied myself quite the Marxist at the time. We're talking about the mid-80s right now, at the height of the war in El Salvador. So there was a lot of political and cultural signs that pointed to radicalization. And given the fact that I'd been repressing myself for so long, it was very attractive to me. So I would qualify myself at that point like a cultural nationalist, a separatist, and a Marxist, and hoping for the spread of this, you know, revolution throughout the continent. That only lasted for a few months, though.
What were the L.A. riots like for you, being a person who feels of such divided cultures? Where were you when they started?
Well, as a journalist, I was with many other journalists at the First AME Church, which I'm sure is familiar to many people around the country now, the African-American church in South Central Los Angeles, where Los Angeles's black leadership had gathered basically to exhort people to refrain from violence. And we were not very far away at all from the flashpoint of Florence and Normandy Avenues, where Reginald Denny and other motorists were beaten. The city exploded around us that evening, and I suppose that I wasn't surprised, because in many of the essays and journalistic pieces that I'd done over the years, I'd been saying that there was the possibility of a long, hot summer in Los Angeles. It was obvious that the city was dry wood waiting to be ignited. But once it did happen, it was very difficult, of course, to see it happen, to see where I'd grown up finally go over the edge. And I guess along with the sadness, the other strong emotion that I felt was anger, a rage that knew no direction, knew no boundaries. I was angry at the city's political leadership for having abandoned basically South Central and most of the inner city for so many years. I was angry at my own culture for the self-destruction and participation in the violence of Latinos and African Americans and Asian Americans. I was angry at the city's white leadership. I was angry at big business for having screwed over the barrios. And I was angry at everybody in the government for having let the infrastructure, such as education and health and everything else, gone down the tubes for so many years, and which paved the way for this rebellion.
We're describing a pretty unified reaction across the board, anger. But I'm wondering if any of the divisions and conflicting loyalties and conflicting identities that you have came into play.
Certainly, and I still feel them now. I mean, I think I just used the word rebellion, and it depends on the context which word I use to describe what happened. Sometimes I say riot, sometimes I say rebellion, sometimes I say uprising. And of course, you know, rebellion or uprising is usually used by people more of the political left that kind of gives, you know, what happened a political import, that it was a purposeful rage, that it was a political protest. The word riot tends to describe a chaotic scene. And I go back and forth on it all the time. There are times when I think that, yes, some of the violence was justified. There are other times that I think that none of the violence could possibly be justified, especially in cases, of course, like the Reginald Denny, the beating at Florence and Normandy, the truck driver who was set upon by youths the first day of the riots. So it's difficult to tell. I think we're still too close to the event to really know what it's going to mean in the long run historically. If in 10 years the Los Angeles uprising of 1992 is looked back upon as the moment that it was like a wake-up call for the city's political leadership, for the city's citizenry to really change the way life is in Los Angeles, and some real change results from that, then we can go back and say, well, perhaps it was a rebellion that led to real substantial social change. But if nothing changes, then what do we call it? Maybe perhaps just senseless rage that led to nothing. And sometimes I'm of the opinion that that's where we're at with it.
My guest is Ruben Martinez. He writes for LA Weekly and is the author of the new book, The Other Side, Fault Lines, Guerrilla Saints, and the True Heart of Rock and Roll. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Ruben Martinez. He writes for the LA Weekly and is the author of the new book, The Other Side. Have you found that your personal friendships have been able to transcend the ethnic divisions of the city, especially after the riots? Or did the riots kind of affect in some way your relationships with friends and colleagues?
Definitely. In the midst of the riots, I'm senior editor at the LA Weekly newspaper here, and during the riots, I felt a lot of ethnic tension, racial tension at the newspaper. I'm one of the very few people of color that worked there, and the riots were all about color, as it were. There was a moment when my managing editor, who is white, came over and pressured me for some copy. And out of nowhere, I don't know where this rage came from. Well, yes, I do. I'm sorry. I do know where this rage came from. This rage just blasted out against him. He was an innocent victim of my rage in that moment. I mean, it didn't have anything to do with him. He was just asking me for copy. But within the context of the riots, his pressuring me for copy became a symbol for what white had done to brown or black for the last 500 years on this continent. To say the least, I profusely apologized later. There was a lot of situations like that in which I felt tension with people who I hadn't felt tension with before. And by the same token, since then, I find myself still going back and forth between perhaps a position of that is more nationalist, where I'd rather be more often with my Latino friends than Anglo friends. But whenever I feel myself going too far to one side, I feel like I have to come back and go to the other side again, because both sides are mine. I mean, as a poet, you know, I read Pablo Neruda, the Chilean poet, as much as I did Walt Whitman. And in my life, if either one of them was missing, I wouldn't be complete. I have to have both Whitman and Neruda there. And as such, in Los Angeles, I need my Anglo friends, I need my African-American friends, I need my Latino friends and Asian friends. And I wouldn't have it any other way. Whether or not we're able as a city to keep it together like that so that friendships like that are possible, sometimes I think that it might be too late, that we started to work out the economic problems that led to this explosion too late. But I'm hoping against hope that it isn't too late.
How did you choose the neighborhood that you live in? And I ask you that because you feel so so much a product of different borders.
I'm living in a northeast of downtown area known as Echo Park. It surrounds a lake. It's not a real lake. It's a man-made lake, but there's real ducks in it. It's an Anglo-Latino-Asian neighborhood. The one cultural element that's missing is African-American. There's no real African-American presence in Echo Park. I wish there was. But precisely because of the mix of ethnicities and because of the class mix, because Echo Park, you go all the way up into the hills and it's quite gentrified, and you go down into the valleys and it's very working class. The sparks that are given off by situation of class and ethnic, you know, mixing like Echo Park are incredible in terms of popular culture. The juxtapositions are wild. You have restaurants that, I guess this has happened before, like in New York, you know, where certain mixes have occurred. But right here in LA and Echo Park now, we have restaurants that have signs saying Mexican Thai food or Cuban Salvadoran food. Teriyaki burritos, which are one of LA's delicacies now. So once again, this points out the possibility of a wonderful third culture or fourth culture or fourth world possible when our different groups come together. And it's also just wonderful to see what I call the process of the tropicalization of Los Angeles taking place. There are street vendors on the corner of Sunset and Echo Park, barrio, selling papayo and papaya and mango and pepino and all kinds of other fruits and vegetables. Whereas our streets had no street life before. L.A. was known as the place of freeways and of sun-washed streets that nobody ever walked, you know, just drove around, right? Well, now people walk again in Echo Park. There's an incredible street life, not just the street vendors, but people hanging out on the porches. It looks like a real city. It looks like a real community, if I could even use that word. It's just breathing again, you know, whereas the streets were lifeless before.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Ruben Martinez writes for the LA Weekly, and he has a new collection of pieces called The Other Side, Fault Lines, Guerrilla Saints, and the True Heart of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, Governor Bill Clinton spoke today by television to the B'nai B'rith here in Washington. They are meeting here in Washington. He's in the South. We'll have a report on that speech. We will have a couple of interesting features on today. One is about video funerals, a kind of video testimonial that can be produced before death to be played at the funeral. We have a report from Haiti that despite all of the best efforts of the U.S. government to discourage immigration, people are still eagerly waiting for the end of the hurricane season and another opportunity to try it. And we'll have an interview with an Olympic medalist.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Those are the opening bars of a new song on the new album by the New York band Sonic Youth. With the release of their seventh album, Dirty, the band has become a veteran presence in the avant-garde wing of rock and roll. But rock critic Ken Tucker says that after 11 years, the band's longevity hasn't lowered its volume or diminished its power.
Sonic Youth's new album, Dirty, was released while I was on vacation recently, so I picked up a cassette of it in a little record store. One of the great advantages of being an experimental rock band that's sold out to a major label like Geffen Records is that your noisy, obscure, difficult music can be easily purchased even in Blue Hill, Maine. As I popped the cassette in the car stereo and let it blast, I suddenly realized that I was messing with nature on a grand scale, shattering the beauty of the cold green forest with the urgent urban blare of Sonic Youth. I was completely and rather happily disoriented by this. The 15 cuts on Dirty tend to bleed into each other, and since I couldn't make out most of the words and have never been able to read liner notes and drive on my side of the road at the same time, I experienced this new Sonic Youth collection as one big, undifferentiated whole, as a kind of rock and roll punch in the head.
What's your name?
I now know that Dirty consists of a series of distinct Sonic Youth attacks. The quartet decries sexism on a song called Swimsuit Issue, theorizes that Supreme Court Judge Clarence Thomas will go to hell on a tune called Chapel Hill, and mourns the death of a friend in JC. I began making distinctions between tracks, preferring for the most part the songs that feature the deadpan yet urgent voice of Kim Gordon. It's a voice that cuts through feedback to demand that you listen closely. The album is produced by Butch Vig, who helped turn the loud clatter of the Seattle band Nirvana into million-selling music. With Sonic Youth, Vig has managed to boost the prominence of their melodies while remaining true to the band's busy, squawking, chaotic sound. And it's that shrewdly messy sound, by the way, not the language, that the album title Dirty refers to.
Switching sunlight, a chase you can catch it every time. But funny how it flies. I learned it all from you, girl. I got it all from you. I had a howl the moon, yeah. I had a scratch dog. I do it every day. Come back again tomorrow and chase the life away.
When I got back from vacation, I was able to break down the components of Dirty and consider it the way I would any other album for a review. But there's a lot to be said for letting an album just wash over you. I don't need a rock band to tell me what to think about Clarence Thomas or swimsuit models, but I do find it helpful to have one really punch me in the head every once in a while.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Spolin and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, novelist Rose Ellen Brown on her stories of families in crisis. And we examine the crisis in healthcare and look at what some states are doing about it. We talk with Trish Riley of the National Academy for State Health Policy. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.